We were discussing the formation of a hemiacetal when we left off. I already covered slide 5, but just to make a smooth transition into today, remember that formation of a hemiacetal involves reaction between an aldehyde and an alcohol, just in general. But that's relevant to this chapter because a single monosaccharide can be both an aldehyde and an alcohol, right? Any monosaccharide is an alcohol because there are hydroxyls, and certain monosaccharides are aldehydes, right? Specifically, what kind of monosaccharides? Well, I don't mean examples, but I mean not individual monosaccharides, but what class of monosaccharides are aldehydes? Yeah, aldoses. So when you have an aldose, you have in one molecule both an aldehyde and an alcohol, which means it can react with itself. This is what causes the ring formation to go from open chain form to cyclic form. Okay? Now in slide 6, the only reason I'm showing you this pyran molecule is because it's a simple ring structure. Notice there are 6 members in the ring with oxygen as one of those. And when an aldose cyclizes to form the ring structure, it ends up making a ring that looks very similar to pyran. So we use the name of that to indicate certain cyclic forms of monosaccharides, like you see happening in slide 7. This is one of the several versions of glucose, right? This is D-glucose. And glucose is an aldose because its carbonyl is terminal, right? C1 is the carbonyl carbon. And it's highlighted in blue because it's going to take part in this reaction forming the hemiacetal. It's going to involve the carbonyl carbon, carbon 1, and it's also going to involve just one of the hydroxyls, specifically the one highlighted in magenta, the hydroxyl associated with the 5th carbon. So you have the open chain form on the left. You still have the open chain form, but it's bent right here in the middle. That's why it says equals here. But it's bending it so that you can see what's actually happening, what's joining with what. So the ring is formed because of the reaction between this 5th carbon and this oxygen associated with the 5th carbon and the first carbon, that leaves the 6th carbon hanging off of the ring. So there are 6 carbons in glucose, but only 5 of them are involved in the 6-membered ring. That other member is oxygen, which is why it looks like pyran that I just showed you. And that's why when a ring form of glucose is made, we call it glucopyranose to indicate its resemblance to pyran. Notice there are different forms of glucopyranose, though, an alpha form and a beta form for each of the L and D forms of glucose. Here, you start with D-glucose and you have 2 possibilities, alpha and beta. The only difference is the positioning of the hydroxyl that is now attached to the carbon 1. Carbon 1 had a double bond originally in the open chain form, right? What happens in the hemiacetal formation is that the double bond of the carbonyl gets broken. Can't remain a double bond because this carbon 1 is already forming 4 bonds, right? Satisfying its valence. You can't hook another thing to it and still have 4 bonds total on that carbon. That would be 5 bonds. So that double bond gets eliminated. All right? What's happening here is that the hydrogen of the pink hydroxyl gets popped off. That leaves an open bond available for oxygen. If you think about this and doing it in terms of molecular models with balls and sticks, that leaves a hole in the oxygen ball, so it's allowed to make another bond. It makes that bond with carbon, but only if you first turn this double bond into a single bond to open up a hole in the carbon. The hydrogen that left the hydroxyl gets remains as a hydroxyl group that can be either above or below the plane that this ring represents when you draw it in this way. So that's the difference between the alpha and the beta form, the positioning of the hydroxyl. If it's below the plane, as you see in the upper right, that's the alpha form. If it's above the plane, it's the beta form. And that doesn't seem like such a big deal, but it is a big deal when you start polymerizing these cyclic versions of monosaccharides. In other words, when you hook these things to other monosaccharides to form polysaccharides, whether they're the alpha form or the beta form determines the overall shape and therefore properties of the polysaccharide that's formed out of these monosaccharides. Carbohydrates have a lot of versatility with respect to shape, just like proteins do, of course. Proteins have a lot of diversity because they have a lot of different monomers, right? There's 20 different amino acids. Well, there are a lot of different monomers when you think about carbohydrates, too, because of all the possible arrangements of their hydroxyls in space. And it becomes in the thousands of possibilities very quickly when you only consider a few basic sugars, but all their different possibilities and then combining them in all the different possibilities. So this is why carbohydrates can also serve an information function. They do that, for instance, serving as little ID tags. Cell-to-cell recognition is an important part of being a multicellular organism, right? You are not just a population of 100 trillion cells that aren't related to each other, that just happen to be living in the same space, right? They all make up one individual, so they need to realize they are part of that individual. Part of that realization is displaying carbohydrate badges, basically, on the surface of the cells that can then be recognized because of their particular shape by proteins on other cells. And that's an important part of being a multicellular organism, because if you didn't recognize your own cells as being self cells, your cells would attack each other, right? They would consider others, your own cells, to be foreigners, to be invaders, which is what your antibodies do when they do encounter something that isn't yourself. It's important to recognize self from non-self. And polysaccharides are involved in that because of there's so many possible shapes of them. All right, so we just looked at the formation of a hemiacetal. In slide 8, we're seeing a similar thing happening, except instead of an aldehyde and an alcohol reacting, we have a ketone and an alcohol reacting. So the only difference here is the position of the carbonyl in this leftmost reactant, right? And so this is once again a general scheme. It wouldn't have to involve carbohydrates. When you react a ketone with an alcohol, you make not a hemiacetal, you make a hemiketal. And once again, this can be done just with a single monosaccharide, because you have monosaccharides that are themselves both a ketone and an alcohol. Specifically, I'm talking about which sugars? Ketoses, right. Instead of aldoses, there are ketoses with a non-terminal carbonyl. They can cyclize to form a hemiketal. So it's not just terminal carbonyls that are able to do this cyclization trick. Furan, in slide 9, is the 5-membered oxygen-containing ring structure that we use the name of to indicate some cyclic form of aldoses, just like we use the other one for for ketoses, sorry, just like we used the other one for aldoses. So in slide 10, you see that happening. Very similar to a couple slides ago, except now we're using fructose. Fructose and glucose are both hexoses, right? They're isomers of each other. They both have six carbons. The difference is the positioning of the carbonyl. So fructose is not an aldose, it is a ketose, because the carbonyl is at carbon 2. But it's still that carbonyl carbon that is involved in the linkage, the completion of the cycle, the ring. Once again, the hydroxyl from carbon 5. Well, since that carbonyl carbon is not carbon 1 but carbon 2, when you close the ring, you don't have as many members of the ring. It's only a 5-membered ring when you count the oxygen. 4 of those members are carbon. That means in the ring structure formed by fructose, you have 2 carbons hanging off of the ring that aren't actually members of the ring instead of just 1. So that's why a hexose can make either a 6-membered ring or a 5-membered ring. It depends on how much of the carbon skeleton is hanging off of the ring. Okay? But because this 5-membered ring looks like furan, we call this structure alpha D fructofuranose. All right? And why is it alpha D? Because the hydroxyl that's formed in this process is below the plane. Okay. 11 now. This chair form and boat form that we're looking at are two possible configurations of these rings. When you look at the rings as they're drawn in slide 10 and in the previous slides, they're drawn in a way that makes them look like they're perfectly planar. The ring is not perfectly planar, and you'll notice that if you actually go through with making a ball and stick model. All those balls are not in the same plane. It's just drawn that way for simplicity. There's really angles between each atom contributing as a member of that ring. And so you have really two possibilities depending on how the bends are at the angles of those, at the vertices of the ring. You have the chair form because it looks like a chaise lounge, right? Head's here, your feet are here. Or the boat form, which is up at both ends, like a canoe. Which do you think is more likely to exist? And why the chair form? Yeah, there is steric hindrance in the boat form. It's cramming things together too tightly. It's not impossible. It's just much less likely. By the way, the A's and the E's here on the top, that just stands for axial and equatorial, depending on whether they are roughly in the plane or off axis. But the chair form is the more common form, and that's what you see in most, not only monosaccharides, but oligosaccharides and polysaccharides as well, which are made up of those monosaccharides hooked together. Okay, now in 12, notice the equilibrium between cyclic form and open chain form. So when this hemiacetal or hemiketal forms, that doesn't mean it's going to permanently lock that monosaccharide into the ringed form or cyclic form. It can go back and forth. It's more often in the ringed form than not. But if it's still just a monosaccharide on its own, it can go back and forth. It can oscillate between open form and ringed form. That there's a chemical difference, though. What do you notice about, other than the ring shape, what do you notice about the open chain form that's not true of the ring form? Yeah. Correct. It's only the open chain form that has a carbonyl group. That carbonyl group is destroyed in formation of that hemiacetal or hemiketal. In the ringed form, there is no double bond anymore. Okay? But it's there in the open chain form. And if you have the open chain form, then we call that thing a reducing sugar. So think back to what oxidation and reduction are, right? Reduction is the gain of electrons, oxidation is the loss of electrons, which is kind of backward seeming to begin with, because you usually think of reduction as loss, but it's the reduction of is the gain of negativity, really, right? But also kind of confusingly, you call something that is becoming oxidized, you call that a reducing agent, right? Because it is reducing something else in the process of becoming oxidized itself. To become oxidized, you have to lose electrons. Those electrons go to something that's therefore becoming reduced, and therefore you, by losing those electrons, are a reducing agent. Okay? And similarly, an oxidizing agent is something that is going to receive electrons because it's oxidizing something else. Well, we call these open chain monosaccharides reducing sugars because that double bond allows for the reduction of certain ions in solution, like these copper ions. Copper 2 ions get transformed into copper 1 ion. And do you recognize that as reduction? Does everyone recognize that as reduction? A copper 2 ion is called a copper 2 ion for what reason? Why is it? I just didn't hear any individual. I heard several. Right. There is a dearth or a paucity or a lack of two electrons, which is why it has a positive 2 charge, right? When an electron gets added to a copper 2 ion, it's still an ion because it doesn't have an equal positive and negative charge, but by adding that one electron, you've made it less positive, right? You've reduced its charge from positive 2 to positive 1, and therefore it's becoming reduced. Well, the thing that is causing that is the sugar. That's the source of the electron, and therefore the sugar is called a reducing sugar. And a solution that contains copper ions is often used as a test. If you have something that you know contains carbohydrates, but you don't know in what form, you can use this copper ion containing solution to form a simple test for reducing sugars. And that's the reason that's handy is because the solution will turn from blue to red when this happens. So and the more that occurs, the more reducing sugars you have in your solution. Well, if you have polysaccharides, that's formed by a bunch of cyclic monosaccharides hooked together, none of which have carbonyl groups, and they don't therefore reduce the copper, so it will stay in blue. If you get a drastic change from blue to red, that means instead of having polysaccharides, you have a bunch of monosaccharides. But that's why monosaccharides are called reducing sugars. Well, just more examples in slide 13 of the versatility of form that monosaccharides can take. Fructose, we've already looked at, can form a hemiketal. And so there are two forms of that for each of the four D forms. There's two. There's an alpha and a beta form, fructofuranose, alpha and beta. But also those can isomerize into 6-membered rings. So fructose can start out as a 5-membered ring and then transform into a 6-membered ring. So there's also fructopyranose alpha and beta forms. So that's all just based on one right-handed version of one hexose. And when you consider all the other hexoses and pentoses, go ahead.
I have a question about
This one?
Yeah. It's
reducing the copper ion. Okay. That's why we call it the sugar, a reducing sugar. It's acting as a reducing agent. The sugar becomes oxidized in the process, though, yeah. Okay, so just versatility, basically. When all we're talking about is monosaccharides so far, there's still a bunch of possibilities, right? Given this fairly simple structure of carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens in these monosaccharides, there's a lot of variety, even though we haven't even talked about many different kinds of monosaccharides. There's just a lot of versions of each kind. And then that gets multiplied when you start adding these things together. That's why carbohydrates have such information capacity, because there's so many ways of hooking them together. Well, speaking of hooking things together, in slide 14 we see that monosaccharides are often substituted, meaning something is attached to it. Up to now we've been looking at just pure monosaccharides, which has, you know, there's quite a variety just in the pure monosaccharides. But then you can also hook other things besides sugars onto monosaccharides. And typically you have things like methyl groups can be hooked to them. The substituents are shown in pink here. Amines can be hooked onto them, nitrogen-containing amines. Phosphates are often hooked onto them. So these are no longer pure carbohydrates. They're no longer pure monosaccharides. But they are molecules that do various things based on what kind of thing you hook onto them. You still have, though, these are not polysaccharides. These are just substituted monosaccharides. Slightly more complex than a monosaccharide, but not a polymer. You're not hooking together a bunch of subunits yet. That's possible, of course, though. So let's go to 15 and look at that. If you think back to the different kinds of isomers that we looked at in that slide that had all the boxes, remember that anomers were one type of isomer that's formed when you make this ring, and that carbon that's involved in closing that ring, which is the one marked with an alpha right here, that's considered to be the anomeric carbon. Because this thing was not in its open chain form, it wasn't an anomer. By closing the ring, you formed yet another asymmetric carbon, which is why it's considered an anomer. Well, the carbon that was directly involved in doing that is therefore called the anomeric carbon. And the anomeric carbon can be used, well, that position can be used to link together two monosaccharides. And when you link together two monosaccharides, you're forming a covalent bond that we call a glycosidic bond or a glycosidic linkage. Now, part of the variability, part of the variety of oligosaccharides and polysaccharides, which are collections of monosaccharides hooked together, right, in both cases. Part of the variety of the ways you can do that, though, is that any given cyclic monosaccharide, which are the subunits, contains multiple hydroxyls. A glycosidic bond or a glycosidic linkage is a covalent bond involving a hydroxyl and an anomeric carbon. Okay? The fact that there are multiple hydroxyls on a given monosaccharide means that there are multiple places that it could form a glycosidic bond with the anomeric carbon of another monosaccharide. Now that's in contrast to the way in which peptide bonds form. Right, you have a high you have several 20 different biological amino acids to work with, but no matter which two you choose to make a peptide bond, there's only one way to make that peptide bond. It has to be between the carboxyl end of one and the amino end of the other. That's the only way. And because of that, because of that, there being only one way to do that, that's why any given polypeptide is unbranched. There aren't branching polypeptides. Because to branch, you would have to have two points of contact between adjacent amino acids, right? And that's why polypeptides are drawn as ribbons, to remind you of the fact that it's one continuous linear strand of amino acids. But when you make oligosaccharides or polysaccharides, there can be more than one connection with other monosaccharides at any given monosaccharide because of the multiplicity of the hydroxyls. Okay? But the anomeric carbon of one of those monosaccharides is going to be involved, which means if the hydroxyls are involved in other linkages, it's going to be an anomeric carbon of that other cyclic sugar that's going to bind to that hydroxyl. Still, though, that means that you can form branches. And when you form branches, there's even more combinations. So that's part of the variability of oligo and polysaccharides as well. This one, particularly, to really specify it, is an alpha-1,4 glycosidic bond, as you see, because it involves carbon 1, the anomeric carbon of this one, carbon 4 of the other one, carbon position 4, position 4, really. Why is it alpha? Because, well, you tell me, what does alpha mean? Hydroxyl below the plane, right? Otherwise, it would be beta if it's above the plane. Well, that's a possibility, too. This one happens to be just two glucoses hooked together. Now, they're exactly the same type of glucose in both cases. Remember, there's multiple kinds of glucose. So you have alpha glucose in its cyclic form, right-handed version in both of these. And what you're forming here by this glycosidic bond is just an example of a disaccharide, right? A disaccharide is a more complex molecule because you've taken two monomers and hooked them together. Now, this isn't yet officially a polymer because poly means many. That's why we don't call it a polysaccharide yet. It's only a disaccharide. Oligo means just several rather than many. So if there are three or four, we still don't call it a polysaccharide. We would call it an oligosaccharide. But that's just semantics, really. They're formed in the same way, one monomer at a time hooked together by a glycosidic bond. Okay? But there's different ways that those bonds can form depending on where you make the connection point with the next sugar. There are several different versions of the same kind of enzyme responsible for making these glycosidic bonds. They're called glycosyl transferases. And glycosyl transferases have to come in various forms because of the variety of different glycosidic bonds, depending on where they're attaching to the sugars. So actually, quite a few genes in your genome are dedicated to just coding for many different versions of glycosyl transferases so that you can make your many different kinds of oligo and polysaccharides, or even disaccharides. Whether you're making a disaccharide, an oligosaccharide, or a polysaccharide, though, what you're doing is really just adding one more to what you already have. So it's a one-at-a-time process, just like translation into a polypeptide is. And you don't just use the monomer itself. It's not energetically favorable to do that. So you have to have an activated monosaccharide which will transfer that monosaccharide to the growing chain. That's what we're looking at here in slide 16. The pink monosaccharide is the thing that you need to hook on to XH, whatever that is. X here can represent another monosaccharide, another oligosaccharide, I mean, the, a growing oligosaccharide, or it could also represent part of a protein, because sugars can get connected to proteins to make glycoproteins. But whatever that is, you need, you can't just use the monomer itself. It's not going to be energetically favored. Hook that on. Instead, you need an activated monomer, which is often UDP glucose. Well, if glucose is the monomer, UDP is the carrier here, though. It's the carrier that is going to pass this activated monomer on to the growing chain. UDP is what type of thing? If you look at just the black and ignore the other colors, or the color, since black isn't. What is the black thing, if just by itself? It is a nucleotide, right. It's more than a nucleoside. Just this ring and this ring together would be a nucleoside, but there's also a phosphate. In fact, there are two. But a nucleoside and at least one phosphate makes a nucleotide. So you have the U stands for uridine. When it's uracil as the nitrogenous base, and that is hooked to ribose, then that nucleoside is called uridine. Just like when it's adenine instead, it's called adenosine. This is uridine. And there's two phosphates, so it's uridine diphosphate is UDP. Well, its job in this case is to carry a monosaccharide so that it can more easily be hooked on to the growing chain, whatever that is. But that still requires the help, not shown here, of an enzyme, some specific kind of glycosyl transferase. Okay, 17 now. We're looking at three different disaccharides here. They're different for a couple reasons. They all have common names, but you've probably heard of all of them before. Sucrose, lactose, and maltose. Sucrose is just table sugar. Lactose gets its name because it's sugar, a disaccharide found in milk. Lactation produces milk. Maltose, or malt sugar, is something that is common in the brewing process, but it's also the only one of these that is a homopolymer, because it's both monomers are the same thing. Maltose is just two glucoses hooked together. Sucrose is a glucose and a fructose hooked together, which is why you have a six-membered ring and a five-membered ring. Lactose is a galactose and a glucose hooked together. So this is another part of the variety of oligo and polysaccharides. They not only have multiple connection points that they can form with each other, but there are also different beads that you can use to make the necklace. Just like there's multiple amino acids, there are multiple monosaccharides that you can use. They don't have to, when you build a polymer, it doesn't have to be made of all the same type of bead, right? It can be, though, and it actually often is. It's often the case that all of the monomers in a polysaccharide are glucose, but it doesn't have to be. So that's one reason they're different. They're made of different combinations of monosaccharides as their monomers. Another difference, though, is in the glycosidic linkages. Notice that in sucrose, this is a linkage involving both anomeric parts of the rings. If you consider this fructose, the five-membered ring, if you were to swivel that with at the O on the top, swivel it, it would be in the position that we've looked at fructose in other examples. It's usually the anomeric carbon is over there on the right corner. But the right corner doesn't mean anything really, right? It's just this thing can be in any position in space. Anyway, this is anomeric and that's anomeric. Not so on the other ones. The anomeric one on both of these are on the right for both rings. So there's a difference in how the glycosidic linkages are formed. But there's also a difference in which anomer is used, the alpha or the beta form. Okay? This one we've already looked at. Maltose was exactly what we looked at in the previous slide. It's two alpha forms of glucose hooked together by a 1,4 glycosidic bond. It's 1,4 simply because it's carbon 1 in one and carbon 4 in the other one. Okay? Now, in 18, we're looking at what I've already described to you, the fact that a single monosaccharide can be hooked simultaneously to two other monosaccharides. So there's a 1,4 linkage here between these bottom monosaccharides, and there's a 1,6 linkage between the diagonal monosaccharides. That is a branch point. That's what's not possible when you string together amino acids. It's only end-to-end. Now, they, of course, fold up into three-dimensional shape, but the bonds are still end-to-end only in a polypeptide. Here you can have branching. And that occurs, for instance, in a storage polysaccharide that you make chiefly. What is we are animals, of course, right? What is the animal form of the main animal form of storage polysaccharide? Glycogen. Glycogen is highly branched. Glycogen is nothing but glucose, which is why it is a storage polysaccharide. I mean, it's a storage polysaccharide because it's formed for the purpose of storing that glucose for later use in energy metabolism to make ATP later. You don't need it at the moment. You have glucose on hand that came in through the gut because you just recently ate. It wouldn't make sense to get rid of it. So it's stored for later, but it's stored in a way that makes it easily packaged by highly branching it, allowing it to interact with a bunch of water molecules, stores it in a compact form. Okay, that's glycogen. Well, plants make a storage polysaccharide just for the same reason. They don't eat their glucose, they make it from photosynthesis, but when they have more than they need for energy demands at the moment, they store it just like we store our ingested glucose, but they do it by polymerizing their glucose a little bit differently in much less branched form, which is why it's not called glycogen in that case. It's called starch, right? Still the same reason that they're doing it, though. That's the storage polysaccharide later on will be depolymerized, catabolized, broken down into individual glucoses, which can then enter the glycolytic pathway for the same reason that you ever enter the glycolytic pathway to make some ATP for you. Okay, now in 19, we can see the importance of the difference between alpha and beta glycosidic linkages. Cellulose is not a storage polysaccharide. It's a structural polysaccharide. So it's there for mechanical strength and structural integrity. It's a major component of cell walls. And for that reason, it's probably the most abundant organic compound on Earth. There's cellulose everywhere because there are so many things with cell walls and there's so many plants in the world. It's able to be a good fibrous material and therefore have nice high tensile strength, resistance to stretching, in other words, or resisting to being pulled on, because it's made not with alpha but with beta glycosidic linkages. But just like glycogen or starch, cellulose is nothing but glucose. It's just using beta linkages instead. That makes a length of glucose monomers or residues when they're hooked together, it makes it more compact than it would be if you hooked them together with alpha glycosidic linkages. And so each little strand can come closer together with another strand just like it side by side, like little individual fibers within an overall cable or rope, right? The closer you can get those together, the more likely it is for hydrogen bonding to occur between the adjacent strands. And that's what these green dashes indicate. Hydrogen bonding between adjacent strands of cellulose into a much thicker cable-like or rope-like fiber made out of cellulose. On the other hand, in slide 20, we see the alpha linkages in starch and glycogen. This is just a little piece of starch or glycogen, just several glucoses long. But when you have nothing but these alpha linkages, which starch and glycogen do, you get more of a helical pattern. This is only one half turn of the helix, but it would continue being helical. Well, a helix takes up more room in space than just a straight strand does, right? And therefore, when you get two of these together side by side, they don't meet up as well as just two straight strands do. And therefore, it's not as strong. But it doesn't need to be strong. The purpose for making this stuff is not structural integrity. The purpose of making this is to just store the glucose for energy, not for building stuff. Okay, now we can go to 21, which is really the beginning of the end of the chapter. This final part of the chapter has to do with combining carbohydrates with proteins. And so there are, when you do that, you form what are called glycoproteins, which linguistically makes enough sense, right? Glyco means sweet and therefore refers to sugars or carbohydrates. So a glycoprotein is part carbohydrate, part protein. The confusing thing about the name is that glycoprotein can be used to describe a whole category, or it can be used to describe one representative of that category, which goes by the same name. So there are three major kinds of glycoproteins, one of which are called glycoproteins. That's the confusing thing. When we talk about the kinds of glycoproteins that are called glycoproteins, those types of glycoproteins are mostly protein, which the name kind of indicates, right? A glycoprotein is a protein, mostly, with a little glyco hooked onto it. So what we're looking at in slide 21 is the connections made between the carbohydrate part and the protein part. There's really only three possibilities. The sugar component, which is shown in black in both of these, or two of these possibilities are shown here. But the sugar component is black. The protein component is in blue. And in each of the blue ones, that's just a single residue of what is an overall polypeptide, right? In fact, it's just the R group the whole residue is shown there. What does the ASN stand for? It's one of the 20 amino acids. It's asparagine, yes. Asparagine is just one of only three residues to which carbohydrates are attached in making glycoproteins. There's 20 amino acids, but only three of them make connection points with carbohydrates. And asparagine is the only one that is said to be N-linked because the amino group of the asparagine R side chain is what makes the connection to the sugar component. There's two possibilities called O-linked, only one of which is shown here. O-linked because it involves an oxygen in the amino acid residue. That oxygen in the amino acid residue can be from a serine, which is what you see as an example here, or threonine. So those are the three types of amino acids that actually can make connection points with carbohydrates to make a glycoprotein. Serine, threonine, both of which are O-linked, and asparagine, which is N-linked. By the way, those ID tags that I was talking about on the surfaces of cells, those are good examples of glycoproteins. The sugar component that hangs off of the protein because of its particular shape, based on how the sugar is built, gives information about what kind of cell that is. Gives that information to other cells that will be able to detect that shape of the sugar with a protein of their own. So these are both membrane-bound proteins. One of them is carrying a sugar, the other one is not, but it's going to recognize the sugar, and that tells one cell, you're one of us. Okay, in 22, we're looking at the substructure of, not the whole thing, but the substructure of the second category of glycoproteins. And notice that we have some repeating subunits here. These repeating subunits are called glycosaminoglycans. I'll spell that. Now, those are sometimes abbreviated as GAG, G-A-G. But glycosaminoglycans are the carbohydrate components of this second type of glycoprotein, and that second category are called proteoglycans. Proteo, of course, referring to the protein component. Unlike the ones we call just glycoproteins, though, proteoglycans have a much higher ratio of carbohydrate component to protein component, which is why proteo comes first on this word, and glycan is really what it is mostly. Okay? We're looking at the kind of the monomers of the glycosaminoglycans to which proteins would then be attached in making the overall proteoglycans. And proteoglycans are really important in places where you need lubricants, in joints, for instance. So chondroitin sulfate, you might recognize that from supplements that are sold nowadays, right? Glucosamine chondroitin. This hyaluronate, or hyaluronic acid, depending on the form it's in, that's an important one in this lubrication function. It has slipperiness to it. Not only that, though, not just the slipperiness, these proteoglycans are really important in withstanding compressive forces, which you get at joints, like especially the knee. You know, each step, your knee joints pound together with a hell of a lot of force, really. You don't notice it when you're young, but it's still as strong when you're young. You're just built well still. You would feel it very much, though, if it weren't for those proteoglycans, because they're acting as shock absorbers. Because of their carbohydrate component, which is the majority of the molecule, like I said, all those hydroxyls interact with water very well, right? Because hydroxyls are polar. And so before the force is exerted, the proteoglycans will absorb a bunch of water like a sponge, basically. And then when you apply the force and the bones get closer to each other and press on that, on the articular cartilages that are made out of a lot of proteoglycans, I mean, that include a lot of proteoglycans, that squeezes the water out, which absorbs a lot of that shock, basically. And then the water will go back in and get squeezed back out every step. So that's a major function of proteoglycans, and you see just a schematic representation of just one part of the molecule in 23. The hyaluronate that we just looked at in the previous slide makes up this blue backbone, in a sense. And then these other glycosaminoglycans are hanging off of the side of that. And so it's basically, that's why it acts like a sponge so well. There's all, in a compact space, there's all of these water-interacting hydroxyls sticking out in all directions. Well, an unusual picture for my slideshows. 24 is here just to remind me to mention chitin. Chitin, C-H-I-T-I-N, is another example of a glycosaminoglycan. And it also is very abundant as a polysaccharide in nature, along with cellulose. And that's because chitin is the chief component of exoskeletons in insects and wing components. It's what makes the exoskeleton of a insect kind of hard, because it doesn't have an endoskeleton like we do, right? If it didn't have that outer shell, it would be very vulnerable. So that's another example of a structural polysaccharide, chitin. And the reason it's so abundant is because insects themselves are so abundant. I mean, just if you only consider beetles, which are just one type of insect, they're just everywhere in the world. Anyway, that's chitin. Now if we go to 25, we see a representation of the third category of glycoproteins. And those are called the mucoproteins, M-U-C-O. Proteins, which can also just be called mucins. Now, these words refer to mucus, right? Which is also a lubricant. Mucus is not only a lubricant. I mean, it is a good lubricant, which is why all parts of your alimentary canal, starting from your mouth all the way to the anus, are mucus. And by the way, when I say they are mucus, I'm using the adjective. M-U-C-O-U-S is the adjective, which means pertaining to mucus, the noun. Mucus, the noun, the actual stuff is M-U-C-U-S. So that's why when you talk about a mucous membrane, you use the adjective form. The membrane is mucus because it produces mucus. Anyway, mucus is rich in mucoproteins, or mucins, and has a slipperiness to it, which is why your alimentary canal is lined with it. It allows the food and then chyme and then feces to slip through fairly easily. But it's also sticky stuff, which is why it's important in your airway, right? Your trachea, which leads to your lungs indirectly, is lined with cells that are mucus, produce mucus. That traps debris that's in the air when you inhale that you don't want to actually make it to the lungs because that mucus is sticky. And then the action of the cilia sweeps that debris upward toward your throat into your esophagus so that you swallow it, put it into your stomach, and get rid of it. Your stomach is the most inhospitable part of your body, so it's the safest place to put something you want to destroy, right? Because of a lot of things can't live in the very acidic environment of the stomach. So those are mucoproteins. Oh, as far as the cartoon is concerned, this backbone on A, which includes the VNTR, that's the protein component. And then hanging off of it are various carbohydrate components. The carbohydrate component of just one of those little strands shown above is shown in detail below. So this is serine or threonine. That's the connection point, like I said before. This is just one amino acid of that big backbone above. And if it's serine or threonine, then it can form a junction with the sugar itself, the monosaccharides of which are represented by the different colored shapes. And I think 26 is the last slide. We're looking at a virus here. In the sphere is a virus invading some sort of cell, part of whose plasma membrane we see. And this is just another example of the interaction between a protein and a carbohydrate on some other cell that is recognized by that protein. But in this case, it is not for the purpose of... this is not for the good of the host cell. It would be for the good of the host cell if the thing doing the recognizing were another cell of that same individual, right? That keeps it from attacking it by antibodies. But in this case, this virus has evolved proteins that also recognize these little ID badges that your own cells have. This happens to be a flu virus. And so the proteins that form, some of the proteins that form the protein coat of the virus itself actually can recognize the particular shape of the polysaccharides hanging off of this glycoprotein. This is the protein component of the glycoprotein in blue, embedded in the plasma membrane. The sugar component of the glycoprotein is hanging off of that, saying, I am this type of cell. But the virus has exploited that fact that you're wearing an ID badge and has evolved its own protein that will recognize that sugar and dock to it. And when it does, a series of events takes place in which it is going to inject its genetic material into the cell, just like any virus does. Right? So, but that's just an example of this interaction between protein and glycoprotein that you see in a... In this case, it's not cell to cell because a virus is not a cell. But in biotic entity to biotic entity, there is this recognition. I guess I'll just end by saying that in a cell-to-cell recognition situation, which is what you want to happen, your own cells recognizing each other, that category of proteins that act as receptors for glycoproteins, the ones that recognize the sugars on other cells, those receptor proteins that do that specific job are called lectins. And without those, we would cease functioning as a multicellular organism. We would just be a mass of cells, individual cells. So they're pretty important. And just as you'd expect, I mean, the whole, I guess, moral of the chapter is that just as you'd expect for one of the four major kinds of macromolecules, carbohydrates, well, polysaccharides are the macromolecules, we can't live without them. They do very important jobs, right? You need all four major kinds. But in the next chapter, we'll talk about lipids. I could start that, or we could just adjourn. Want to go ahead and adjourn? All right.